Coming up on today's program.
We shouldn't have gotten involved with trying to do anything about slavery, and we basically should have butted out of the whole thing. They just felt that the North should mind their own business.
The Great American Divide. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. Coming up later in the program, we've got Veterans Voices, Bird Notes, and Dan Patterson has our pre-flight checklist. Up first, Dan Gettiman is an Antioch College graduate and WISO alum with a long career in public radio. On January 13th, Gettiman's new podcast, The Copperhead Conspiracy, will make its debut. The podcast looks at how thousands of Northerners during the Civil War conspired with the Confederacy and tried to, sometimes through violence, end the Civil War. We spoke with Gettiman about the conspiracy and the part Ohio played in it.
It's a pretty amazing story that I stumbled on about 7 years ago while I was researching another public radio and podcast series that I produced called The Reckoning, which was about the history of slavery in Kentucky. And as I was researching one prominent slave holder here in Louisville, Kentucky, where I'm based, I found out that he was arrested for treason and was given a death sentence for being involved in some sort of conspiracy with the Confederacy. And that piqued my interest. And I kind of pulled on that thread and learned a whole lot about this conspiracy, which in essence, to sort of summarize it, there were a group of Northerners, in particular in the Midwestern states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Kentucky, who were deeply angry at Abraham Lincoln and his administration and the fact that they were even in a civil war against the South. And they felt strongly that it shouldn't exist, the civil war, that we didn't have a beef with the South. We shouldn't have gotten involved with their desire to secede. We shouldn't have gotten involved with trying to do anything about slavery. And we basically should have butted out of the whole thing. They just felt that the North should mind their own business. And this began as a political disagreement. And as the Civil War progressed, and as more and more soldiers were dying, as more and more Northern young men were being drafted into the army, they started to become radicalized. And that radicalization eventually turned into violence. And so there started to be acts of violence committed against Northern soldiers. This is in the North. So this would be in Ohio in particular, where there were armed insurrections, armed attacks on Northern soldiers, on government workers who were involved with signing men up for the draft. This was a big flashpoint. So an example of one of these happened in 1863 in Holmes County, Ohio, where a group of armed men physically attacked the guy who was signing people up for the draft and beat him badly. And as a result of this, they called in the army to suppress this rebellion. And there were, you know, shots fired and people were wounded. I never knew this stuff happened. And by the way, this happened all over the United States, not just in Ohio. It happened in Indiana. It happened in Kentucky. It happened in Pennsylvania. It happened in New York City. There were these rebellions, these uprisings, armed uprisings all throughout the Civil War, you know, very similar in some respects to what happened in the 1960s against the Vietnam War. So you had massive draft resistance that turned into violence. And eventually, this desire to fight back against the Union Army and the government of the United States escalated to the point where there were tens of thousands of armed men in the North, in states like Ohio, who were actively planning on overthrowing the governments of the states of the Midwest, assassinating the governors, assassinating the leaders of the legislature, and installing new governments to take over those states, which were going to secede from the United States into a separate new country to be called the Northwest Confederacy, which was then going to align itself with the Southern Confederacy and end the Civil War, essentially by having more citizens and more soldiers at their disposal than the North.
So you pulled on this thread And it sounds like a lot unraveled. There were, in this group of people, if I understand, there was an Ohio congressman involved in all this?
Yes. So there were quite a few elected leaders in Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Kentucky, in particular, also Missouri, who were actively involved in this conspiracy. There were sitting U.S. senators. There were sitting U.S. congressmen. There were miscellaneous state officials. The Chief Justice of the Appellate Court of Kentucky ran the conspiracy in Kentucky, for instance. And by the way, one of the conspirators eventually became the Vice President of the United States later in the 19th century. The sitting congressman from the district that represents the Hamilton, Ohio area, a guy named Clement Vallandigham, was the ringleader nationally of this conspiracy. He ran a secret organization called the Sons of Liberty, of which he was the supreme commander. And this was, think of this as kind of a paramilitary organization along the lines of the Ku Klux Klan, but at a much, much larger level. So, you know, tens of thousands of members who were armed, had explosives, rifles, sidearms, were actively drilling, you know, fields in the country to prepare for this insurrection. Or another way to think about it would be, any number of groups in the Middle East, like ISIS or the Taliban, who are, you know, were these paramilitary organizations fighting against the governments of their respective countries. You know, so these were very well-funded, well-drilled paramilitary organizations. And the guy at the head of it was a U.S. congressman from Ohio. And that guy ends up getting arrested for treason, kicked out of the country, ends up in Canada as an exile. And while there, runs for governor of Ohio and is in fact selected as the Democratic nominee in 1863 to be the governor of Ohio while he is exiled for treason.
Let's go back to the ties between these events and what's happening today. Certainly, there's no shortage of political violence on either side, the right and the left. But how should we look at events, particularly within the construct of American ideology from its founding on? Sorry, that sounds like a kind of convoluted question.
Yeah, no, I think I can answer the question. Ken Burns just ran his American Revolution series, starting with the founding of this country. So we started in a revolution against a perceived tyrant, King George, and baked into the U.S. Constitution and the Declaration of Independence explicitly is this notion that if you strongly disagree with what is happening in your government, you have the right to rebel against it. Okay, it's baked into both our founding documents, but also into the ethos of this country, right? So the people both in the South and in the North that we're talking about, the Copperheads, firmly believed they were part of the same historical trend that the, quote, patriots in the American Revolution lived by in terms of taking up arms against tyranny. And by the way, the main organization that undertook this Copperhead conspiracy styled themselves as the Sons of Liberty, explicitly taking the same name that the early patriots used in violent rebellion against the British crown. So that notion that we always reserve the right to use violence when we believe government officials or government entities are misbehaving has never gone away in this country. It just pops up like a bad penny every few decades. And so it's been a cyclical thing that's happened throughout the United States history. It certainly happened throughout the early 19th century leading up to the Civil War, but it has happened throughout the 20th century. There have been armed rebellions in the United States around the time of the First World War and in the aftermath of the First World War in the early 1920s, happened again in the run-up to World War II, definitely happened in the 1960s and 1970s. We've seen it, you know, with the militia movement. We've seen it with all sorts of paramilitary white supremacist groups, neo-Nazis, et cetera, that have been organizing, again, armed paramilitary groups ready to take action. We've seen it in the recent past with the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. This is a thread in American history that I don't think will ever go away. It just can be sort of temporarily suppressed, and then it pops back up. And I don't know that it is unique to America's history, but I think it is very specific to American history in terms of this feeling, this sincere intellectual justification for taking up arms against the government when you strongly disagree with its policies.
It's a fascinating subject. The new podcast is called The Copperhead Conspiracy, and it will be debuting on January 13th on all podcast platforms.
All the major podcast platforms, just go, whichever one you use, just put in The Copperhead Conspiracy and you'll find us.
Dan Gettemann, thanks so much for the conversation and good luck with the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Up next on Why So Weekend, in this edition of Veterans Voices, Ohio Army combat veteran Mary Skrenta now teaches art to fellow vets. She says she's learned with the help of art to turn the trauma and the struggles into victories.
Mary Skrenta is a disabled Army combat veteran who now teaches art to fellow veterans, including a few that are on this season of Veterans Voices. For as long as she can remember, the arts called to her. And it was in that very calling that led her to enter the military.
I really have to be honest with you that I joined the military for the college benefits because I had always loved the arts. I've loved the arts. It's one of my earliest memories. And I wanted to go to art school. And an art education is a very expensive education, even back then. So I went into a recruiting office and I said, I want the least amount of time in. I want for the most amount of college money, and I want to go to Europe. And if you can give me that, I will do it. And so that's what happened. I was absolutely like a fish out of water and immediately regretted what I had done. However, I made the commitment and I am one to honor my commitments. And for a long time after being in the military, I hid the fact that I was a veteran, but I realize that now that is such an integral part of my journey. So I'm very proud of the fact that I did what I did and I survived what I survived, and I'm using my powers for good, not for evil.
Mary went on to study and become an artist, but she never imagined herself teaching it until a friend asked her to step in and finish the drawing class he'd been leading.
And from the first 5 minutes, I absolutely knew that I had found a calling. I love making art, but teaching it is so rewarding and so powerful because it's not just the skills. It's the sharing. It's the empowering others with this opportunity for expression. I've learned with the help of art to turn the trauma and the struggles into victories that enable me to help and teach other veterans like I would never be able to otherwise. There is a lot of stuff that happens when you're in the military, combat especially, very harrowing experiences. You know, you're faced with big things. You're faced with life and death situations. And you want to express them creatively. And art is therapy. And in all the art and teaching that I'm doing, that comes into play. This program we're doing, the Veteran Arts Initiative, part of the Whole Health Program, what we're doing here is cutting edge, and it's just amazing. And I'm very proud to say that I'm the only teacher working with these veterans who is also a combat veteran with higher level art teaching experience. So I'm very proud of that. In fact, we just got done with a 6-week course last week, and we're all hugging and saying goodbye, and they'll miss me. And it's just such a rewarding experience. I've literally had folks in tears telling me this got them out of depression. They have something that all the thoughts in their head, they can now express. And that, to me, is the biggest paycheck. Like, that is worth $1 million. I just love it so much.
Veterans Voices is presented by WrightPath Credit Union. Additional support comes from the Dayton Ombudsman Veterans Transition Team and Montgomery County Veterans Service Commission. Veterans Voices is produced here at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks again for tuning in. For decades, Ohioans have had multiple tools at their disposal to keep air polluters in check. But Ohio's budget bill, passed this past summer, strips away some of those options. Environmental groups are now suing Ohio to restore those rights. As 2025 came to a close, I spoke with WISO's environmental reporter Adriana Martinez-Smiley for an explanation of what's unfolding in court and why. Hello, Adriana.
Hi.
Tell us first what this lawsuit is about.
So in this lawsuit, environmental groups like the Ohio Environmental Council and Sierra Club allege that the Ohio legislature unlawfully added air pollution amendments into the Ohio budget bill this summer. So it's House Bill 96, and it set the budget for the state of Ohio for the next 2 years. But the bill also included a provision telling the Ohio EPA to repeal a 50-year-old air nuisance rule. It also included a restriction on community air monitors, saying that they can no longer be used in regulatory enforcement. The groups say that this is unlawful because the Ohio Constitution has a clause known as the single subject rule. This states, quote, "No bill shall contain more than one subject, which shall be clearly expressed in its title," end quote. So I spoke with environmental attorney Miranda Lepla, who is representing the OEC and Sierra Club, and she gave more details on why the state constitution requires this.
The legislature is moving a piece of legislation, you might want to send a letter to your representative. You might want to testify in front of the legislature about why you think it's a good or bad idea.
So the Ohio Attorney General's office is representing both the state of Ohio and the Ohio EPA, but the Attorney General's office didn't respond to my request for comment.
The air nuisance rule has some history. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so this is actually the third time that officials have tried to remove this rule. It was actually reinstated earlier this year. The reason why environmental groups care about this rule so much is because of its citizen suit provision. So this defines air pollution as a public nuisance and allows citizens and local governments to threaten air polluters with legal action if they suspect they're violating the Federal Clean Air Act. This can be found in Ohio's federal plan to enforce the Clean Air Act. The Ohio EPA can still enforce the Clean Air Act using state regulations, but Ohio doesn't have an equivalent to the citizen suit provision. General Counsel for the Ohio Environmental Council, Chris Tavner, explained this to me.
The air nuisance rule ensures that individuals can be pursuing complaints where they're being harmed, especially in the absence of potential action from state or federal agencies.
So typically, it's the business community that's favored repealing the rule, such as the Ohio Oil and Gas Association or the Ohio Manufacturers Association. They say that they want to avoid citizen lawsuits that are unsubstantiated or that it should be left up to the Ohio EPA or US EPA to find violations. As part of the process to remove the air nuisance rule, the Ohio EPA had to allow public comments on the proposal. And a majority of these comments supported keeping the air nuisance rule. In a letter that it sent to the U.S. EPA, the Ohio EPA says that it doesn't use the air nuisance rule, nor is it required to maintain national ambient air quality standards of the Clean Air Act.
Another key piece of this lawsuit is the restriction on community air monitoring. Why is that important, according to the plaintiffs?
There were previously no restrictions on the use of community air monitoring data. So anything that isn't an EPA-grade monitor or installed by way of a permit is considered a community air monitor. The reason that they're concerned about this is because EPA-grade air monitors aren't easy to come by. They're very expensive, so the litigants say they're cost prohibitive. And the state or federally sanctioned air monitors can be miles away from polluting sources, which can result in air monitoring deserts, as Lepla put it.
Okay, so what would be impacted?
The lawsuit mentions members of the Ohio Environmental Council that would be directly impacted. These members installed 16 community air monitors in Granville, where they live. And the purpose was to track air quality data as nearby industry expands. They did it in collaboration with Google and Ohio State. All of the monitors together cost $7,000. But the plaintiffs say a single EPA-grade monitor would cost $50,000. A Middletown resident named Donna Ballinger is also a plaintiff in the case. She says she used community air monitoring equipment to gather evidence of pollution coming from a neighboring steel plant. She was also planning to use the air nuisance rule for enforcement, but with these changes, neither of those things will matter. She says she's been making reports to the Ohio EPA, so the air nuisance rule would have been another option she could exercise. Here's what Ballinger had to say on the case.
I hope that the lawyers and the courts do the right thing for people that are up against anyone that's polluting.
So then, what's next?
To be clear, the air nuisance rule isn't officially repealed. That's up to the US EPA to make that call. But there will be a comment period at that time as well. That hasn't been announced. A judge will decide on the case without a live trial, but there's not a date available for when that will take place.
Okay. Adriana Martinez-Smiley, thanks so much for your reporting on this.
Thank you.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us this weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Our next story comes at the close of 2025 as well, when places of worship filled with holiday music. Most people experienced it through their sense of hearing, but at one small church in North Dayton, the congregation experienced music in a unique way. For Culture Couch, WISO's Community Voices producer, Shelley Hulse, visited the Miami Valley Baptist Church for the Deaf.
The music here is louder than you'd expect. That's intentional. This congregation is mostly deaf. They don't hear their hymns. They feel and experience them. Pastor Dave Solomon has led this small congregation for 3 years.
Good morning.
He's been deaf since contracting measles as a baby. We spoke through his American Sign Language interpreter, Annette Paulus. I'm asking her questions. She signs them to him. He signs his response, and then she voices his words. I asked him what makes worship work when you can't hear the music.
So that sound system really needs, it's really important for the vibration, for that bass, to really feel the bass during that worship time. If you're not feeling that, if you don't feel that vibration or the bass and it's really quiet, it's just kind of like, eh. But when you have that, when I'm really close to the speaker, all that vibration just really hits my body and I love it.
Well, that's a great part of worship. Yeah, the physical part. Solomon says for some hearing visitors, it can be overwhelming.
Now, for hearing who come, that is really loud and it can hurt your ears, but we like it.
I liked it. I like it loud. Pastor Solomon's wife, Kellen Solomon, found the church through a newspaper ad 30 years ago. She is also deaf. She'd been raised Lutheran, but couldn't find a deaf accessible congregation in Dayton. She says at hearing churches, she didn't fit in. I spoke to her through Paulus, the interpreter, in the same way I spoke with her pastor husband.
A lot of hearing churches, they don't allow deaf to be involved at all. And you just sit there doing really nothing and feeling deflated about it. Being able to be involved in drama and really getting my hands involved in it is amazing.
That involvement shapes how the congregation experiences music, Pastor Solomon says. Facial expressions carry the emotion. Hands don't just sign words, they sign feeling.
Yeah, facial expressions, as well as with adding that emotion to your body, so you're really drama and theatrical with it, and really just covered in the Holy Spirit. It's just amazing.
The congregation is older. Outside funding is rare. But whether it's a Sunday in June or Christmas Eve, they gather the same, bass thumping, hands moving.
Really, it's just a way to spread the gospel, that's all.
For Culture Couch, I'm Shelley Hulse.
You can find more Culture Couch stories on our website at wyso.org. And before any airplane leaves the ground, a pilot runs through a checklist to make sure nothing important is overlooked. Every aircraft has its own. On this episode of Blue Skies and Tailwinds, Dan Patterson shares his own checklist.
You've got the airplane reserved, have done your planning and called flight service for the current weather briefing. These are accurate for about 4 to 5 hours. Being a VFR pilot, that's visual flight rules, mostly a blue sky flyer, could be high clouds or overcast, but mainly clear weather. The plane I flew was a Cessna 182RG, RG for retractable landing gear. more powerful than the smaller Cessnas and could carry a reasonable amount of stuff. The time-honored aviator's ritual, which Orville and Wilbur Wright created, is to walk around the airplane that you're about to fly. In a way, you're walking in their footsteps every time you do this. You put your hands on the structure, the skin of the plane, feel and move every control surface. Make sure they all move freely. What the Wrights didn't create is the aviator's checklist. That concept was also created in Dayton, but that's the subject for another episode. Ailerons move up and down in the opposite direction on the other wing. The elevator moves up and down without any hitches, and the rudder swings easily side to side. After all, these are extensions of you as the pilot while flying. Check the wheels and brakes. No fluids leaking or any weird-looking stuff. Slide your hands along the leading edge of the propeller to feel for any nicks or gouges. Check the oil level with a dipstick. Be sure to have a rag or a paper towel before and after. Check the fuel for the right color, and be sure there isn't any water collected. Climb up a ladder and take the fuel caps off to check the fuel levels visually, and a good idea is to put a measuring stick into the tank. The stick is marked with how much is in there by how wet the stick is and where. The airplane is untied and ready. Look all around the area before climbing into the left seat. Review the checklist. Buckle in and turn on the master switch. The plane begins to come to life. Turn on the flashing beacon. Stand on the brakes and open the window and yell, "Clear prop!" Prime and start the engine. Got to keep an eye on the oil pressure and the fuel gauges and the electrical gauges. The airplane is now a living creature. At a small, uncontrolled airport, you can taxi to the runway. At a larger airport with a control tower, you need to be fully capable of radio procedures and must have permission to taxi and to take the runway. Before you get to the runway, you need to run up the engine and before that, stand on the brakes again. Check the magnetos by switching off one and then the other. I could go into why there are two, but that's another story. Keep an eye on the engine gauges, throttle back, taxi in a circle to look for traffic intending to land on the runway you're about to be lined up on. Trim your airplane for takeoff. Satisfied that the coast is clear, taxi onto the runway. Line yourself up with the center line. Look around again. Advance the throttle all the way. Listen for any weird noises or anything that doesn't sound normal. This is it. Release the brakes. Keep some right rudder kicked in and steer the airplane down the runway using the rudders. The center line is there for a reason. Keep your eyes on the runway and the instruments and feel the airplane begin to fly. The airspeed instrument will give you the numbers, but this is where you become one with your airplane. You'll know when you're flying. Climb out once you clear the airport environment and reach the altitude you're expected to be at and turn onto the heading for where you're going. Then the wonder and magic of flying can consume you. You throttle back to a cruising speed, the plane is trimmed for level flight, and you are on the proper heading. Now the realization that you're in the sky and alone with your aircraft. The Ohio landscape slowly unrolls beneath you. The roar of the engine is muffled by your headset and becomes a background buzz. It's all about flying. For WYSO, this is Dan Patterson, wishing you blue skies and tailwinds.
This is Bird Note. There is strong debate about whether pet cats should be kept indoors or allowed to roam freely. But outdoor cats kill billions of birds each year in North America, and they live much shorter lives than indoor cats. That's why cat behaviorists like Animal Planet's Jackson Galaxy advocate for keeping our cats indoors.
At the same time, that does take away from their lives in a pretty significant way. They wake up every morning needing to go and kill something. So, what do we do?
Jackson says it's essential to enrich the life of an indoor cat. And first on the list is committing to a play regimen with them.
Not just waving a wand around. It's about committing to the game. You're role-playing, you know? It's method acting. You are a mouse. You are a bird. Get into it.
Just 15 minutes of play can make a huge difference in your cat's life. Next up is enhancing their indoor environment.
We start with the concept of cat TV. Make the windows a destination. Put bird feeders near the window. You're giving them that ability to sort of passively engage with their raw self.
It takes some work on our part, but both our cats and the birds are worth it. You can learn more ways to make your cat happy indoors on our podcast, Bring Birds Back. sponsored by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Listen in your podcast app or at birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.
That's a wrap on this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Our podcast is available to download and subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts. Our theme music for the program is Another Beautiful Day in Paradise by Magnolia Bolthead. I'm Jerry Kenney. We've got more highlights and conversations for you next weekend. Please join us then.